We're starting the show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries and creatives, and story, music and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I air an interview I did with the multi-talented Keo Griffith. I recorded that on August 31st, 2022. We start the show with music by local favorite Anthony Alvarez, Bright Out, and wrap up the show with music by Shaman Durek, My House. Stay tuned!
While the door is sticking for a ride. been looking, yeah, 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 yeah. Can someone tell me when it's right out? I've been looking, yeah, yeah,
I'd like to introduce Keo Griffith. I met you through an artist from Taiwan named Yuzhen, and she was doing some kind of performance art, conceptual stuff here in LA.
Really interesting stuff. She was playing a video and performing in the video herself. Like, I think she became part of the projection. And the installation had stuff that she found in LA, like the trinkets and Chotskys and stuff that she found interesting. Probably not interesting for us, but but you know, I think it's mostly about color that she got really into. The first conversation I had with her was how the color in LA was so different from Taiwan, you know.
Well, you could see it on movie immediately, you know. Oh, that was shot in LA. You can see on TV. It's just like this lighting here. It's
just like
Southern California.
Like the hues and the tones are like off the charts. is what she said. You know, like how do you come with those colors?
And this is something we artists struggle with, because I don't think she's gotten famous. I don't think a lot of people have seen her art or understand it, but as artists, we're transmitting something internal, or perhaps we're trying to do something deliberately commercial, but nevertheless, we are often ignored. Or maybe it's hard to understand us. Like, maybe it's brilliant. Maybe in 100 years after we're dead, somebody will realize our genius, but it's hard being an artist.
I think so, but I'm not really thinking about that all the time. So maybe I might be in a different framework. Like, I'm not too preoccupied about being famous, really. But it's more about having fun. And I think it's because I also hang out with musicians quite a bit. So it's really like creating stuff in the moment. And it's not meant to be permanent, you know? So when the moment's over, that you don't really take anything back home with you, you know.
Sounds like you're very present with the creation, and you're not all about celebrity and fame. And it's some people that's.
I mean, I wouldn't mind it, of course. I think that there's a lot of fun in that too. Like I said, you know, everything's kind of improvised with what I do, and it's not meant to last. So. I'm not too hung up about thinking about making things archival.
It's the art of creation that's very attractive to you.
Yeah, this kind of precarious and fragile and, you know, flimsy. It's like it's holding up right now, but not in the next hour, right? But that's the kind of stuff that really excites me.
I like the way you describe it. It's fragile, and why hang something on it like fame, notoriety, unnecessarily? Well, tell us about yourself. I was going through your bio, and you've just done so many things and been part of a lot of groups and organizations. And
I'm born in Japan. It's this place called Kugenuma Kaiga, which is beach. And it's sort of like the mirror image of Malibu over there. When I was born that time, it was kind of like a old fisherman's village. And now since 2010, maybe earlier than that, it's a total surfer town now. So, you know, you see surfboards in the backyards, not dried fish strung on clotheslines, you know. Not that, but it used to be that before. So that's the change. And also that area in the next town, which is the old capital, it's called Kamakura, where you've probably seen this Buddha, bronze Buddha statue.
Mm-hmm.
That's right by the beach.
Famous.
Yeah, so I'm right by that area. And that was this third capital in the 13th century.
After Edo?
No, actually after Kyoto.
Okay.
So it's now Kyoto, and then it moved to Kamakura because they had a civil war.
Oh, yeah.
And they had some refugees who ended up becoming the warlords instead of a capital in that area.
Quite a interesting history, and not too many Americans know about Japanese history, but they don't teach it here. But a lot happened.
Well, same thing with me too. I didn't really learn American, you know, U.S. history in Japan. So
yeah, we'll get a little.
I'm learning as I go while I'm here.
Self-absorbed over here. You've lived in two countries, speak at least two languages. I'm sure Japan has had a big influence on your consciousness and art.
Yeah. I have a tendency to think I'm Japanese first because of the upbringing. Yeah.
And
my mother's Japanese too, so there's that connection.
You came here when you were?
After high school.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just got into the whole.
Yeah, I couldn't really find a decent art university over there. It was going to be all technical, which was not my interest. I wanted to be more, you know, think about ideas and conceptualize things and, you know, more about the weird.
It was more aspects. Like towards
like your paintings on the wall, right?
Like my paintings.
Yes, that's what I'm more interested in. And that wasn't available.
I have absurdist art all over my studio here.
But where that was available was in the commercial world, in graphic design and advertisement and TV commercials. You've seen Japanese TV commercials, right?
Very creative. Yeah.
So that surrealness I really liked. But I didn't really see that translated into fine art as much. It resided in graphic design and illustrations, but not in paintings and sculpture. So when I saw, you know, works like Mike Kelly or Paul McCarthy, it's like, oh yeah, you know, that's where I want to go. I want to learn more about that.
And instead of going the real professional commercial art route, you felt like coming to LA, you could become really more of an artist, a fine artist.
Right.
And for people who don't know, this is a big push and pull between commercial art, making a living, and fine art, just doing art for art's sake and like letting your muse out. And this is a constant tension, and because we need to pay our bills, but we also don't want to be in some cubbyhole, you know, drawing the same thing 1,000 times or just a logos for companies we don't care about. So this is a tension. Mm-hmm. But you seem to have found your place in the more fine arts world.
Well, actually, I also practice as a graphic designer, too. So
okay.
I've done a few of those logos.
So you pay your rent. Good for you.
I've done a few of those logos for people. But the way I see it, I try and come up with these, you know, iconic things that makes sense to me, maybe not to them, and I try to negotiate that. You know, it's like you got to use this image. It's much better than that letter, you know, straightforward letter form logo that you may be thinking about. You know, that everybody else uses.
Even in whatever the most mercenary or corporate world, you can still breathe in some kind of energy, so that. It's actually
maybe humor.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
because, you know, in business or maybe graphic design or advertising, although there is humor involved, there's an underlying seriousness to it, right? And, you know, you feel that the whole time. There's tension, but it never really gets wild and crazy, you know. So that's where I want to tap into.
And after education. Now, there's this whole list of projects you've been a part of. Tell me about it.
See, that's the problem. It's like I'm too involved in so many things that I
9 RPM, Cafe Mode, Fabric Media, Art Bridge Institute, Transit Republic, IMMI, OOTE41221. And radio DJ at NetNet Radio.
Right. That's probably the more current one that I'm working on. That happened because I was posting all these album covers, and like, you know, rare vinyl stuff during the pandemic. And then a friend of mine who was a DJ at this radio DJ group in TJ in Mexico messaged me and said, "Do you want your own radio show?" So that's how that happened.
So we got a musician too.
Yeah. I actually do quite a bit of that too.
Again, something we find in a lot of artsy people. We go in a lot of directions.
Yes. Like a crazy wind vane.
Joni Mitchell. And now she's doing, instead of folk rock, now she's doing jazz. Now, you know what I mean? Like people, we want to do different things.
Yeah, Joni Mitchell's my hero. I really love her music and her artwork.
Artwork, right.
Yeah, because, you know,
Elvis Costello, like we go in different directions.
It's difficult when you're already like a really good folk musician and then to translate all that energy and talent into jazz. And it's not just your straight ahead jazz, it's free jazz, working with Mingus, right? I think that's amazing. And then that record that she put out with Mingus, you know that one, right?
And most people haven't heard of it.
Yeah, I know.
They've heard of Blue, but they don't know anything about it.
Don't know anything about that one.
Yeah.
I might be wrong, but I think it was produced right before Mingus passed away. And I think it's 52nd or 53rd birthday, maybe. Yeah. It's hard to believe that because we've already surpassed that age.
Let's talk about the fine arts projects, though, and what you're currently working on.
I've been invited to work on this island in this area called Setouchi, which is the inland sea. Do you know this place called Naoshima, which is the art island in Japan?
No, but I want to go.
It's mostly built by this architect, Tadao Ando. It's all concrete, and there's a James Turrell installation in there. There's also Yayoi Kusama sculpture installation in there, too. And it became like the headquarters of the region, which is this, you call it the Inland Sea, because it's between the main island of Japan and between two other smaller islands. Well, they're not sizable islands in a way that they're small. You know, it's sort of like, you know, if you imagine like Ireland being an island, right? So you got two of those in the west, and then there's the mainland. And there's this crevice or a niche area where there's a whole channel of, I would say, maybe 200 to 300 islands, smaller ones. Half of them are uninhabited. Used to be in the medieval times, they had pirates in that area.
Hmm. Some history.
Yeah, which is really interesting. So, I've been approached by a curator who's also a paraplegic who saw one of my pieces, which was a sound installation, in a 2016 arts festival in Nagoya. Nagoya is like in the central area of Japan. It's also a sister city of LA.
Oh.
Yeah. So, it's a long story though. I should tell you what that was about. I traveled the whole country recording like what you have here. I had a Zoom H4.
It's a little handheld, high-quality recorder.
Yeah. Probably not as high-res as your H6 here, but I would go from town to town and look for dialects that were probably going to be extinct.
Hmm.
You know? It's sort of like that music listening habit. Like, you want to keep exploring. You know, you want to listen to the ones that everybody loves, right? The Stones or the, you know, Beatles or Zeppelin or you know, Mingus or whatever, right? But then you're curious about the other ones that nobody knows about.
Yeah.
And then some of those are gone, right? So they don't quite make it as a reissue.
Mm.
So the same thing with dialects too, right? It's like in these villages that are probably down to like less than 100 people population, and they don't really have young people there anymore, right? So then how do you transfer that to the next generation, right? It doesn't really happen anymore.
Let me just interrupt by saying our kind of stupid American awareness, we think of perhaps Japan as one thing, there's one language, but obviously there's a lot of regional foods, regional dialect, maybe very different from each other. Mm-hmm. Even like Okinawa was not even Japan.
It was a kingdom on its own.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but we lump things together and simplify it. But now we're understanding, yes, there's a lot of variety
in
Japan.
Yeah. And, you know, I also realize that I habitually forget about these, you know, nuances and in between noises, and you know, until I really pay attention to it, right? I think most of life, you pick things that are louder, or brighter, or polarized, or you know, the attention-getting things, right?
Like popular things.
Exactly. Yeah. Popular things. So then I decided that I'm going to explore the unpopular.
Oh, so that's something.
Yeah.
This is what I feel about
that
you.
Means. And then it's like, what does unpopular mean? It means maybe what we talk about is diversity, right? That's also part of it too, probably. Or maybe an entryway for it.
Yeah, you're just like the guy who wants to examine the silence between the notes.
Yes,
you
know, yes. I'm really curious about that.
Yeah.
Like, is there anything there that can be recorded?
Got it.
Right.
And I'm sure...
I want to get that spec.
I'm sure there's a lot of regional religions. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of difference in what people believe.
Right.
Or the gods they worship. Because the religion there is much more ancient.
Mm-hmm.
Where ours is, you know, at most a couple hundred years old in the United States. So it's going to be just a few.
Mm-hmm.
But the older you get, the more branches there's going to be.
Yeah, that's a really good example, too, because you have all these sects, right?
Yeah.
And you think Japan is mostly Shinto, which is the sun god religion, or Buddhism. But Buddhism is from China. And then from China, it's actually from India. So, you know.
Siddhartha.
There's all this borrowed religion, right? Or influential religion, or whatever you might call it. But then when it lands in Japan, it just splits up even more, right? You got the Nichiren, for example, right? Who was like a underdog of the Zen Buddhism.
Rebel riser.
Right, rebel riser. Yeah, he got incarcerated so many times.
And probably from town to town, there's little local deities people worship?
Yes.
This is not in the United States. There's no local thing like that.
Oh, you mean a stone statues.
Or little yoki?
Right.
Yeah, local gods or this or that.
Right.
I'm ignorant, but I'm assuming.
No. There's a temple for everything.
Right.
There's a temple for mushrooms, too.
Okay.
Actually, there's a temple for fungus.
Okay, yeah. Well, one of our favorite. Of course, over here, we see the ones devoted to phalluses or something.
Right.
So you took some time and spent time in villages talking to the elderly people and wanted to get these things on tape. Nobody's there doing that? I mean, it seems like an obvious thing to want to preserve.
Mm-hmm. So it started that way. And then, you know, I can't let my mind be focused in one area. And I realized it was more like a performance, right? Because the way I look, I don't really look Japanese.
Oh.
And I visit these villages where, you know, some of them, they probably haven't seen much, too many foreigners around.
So there's a suspicion.
Yeah. So I come in with a recorder and I say, can I interview you in Japanese? And it's like, they're shocked, you know, because I don't really have an accent.
Ah. So this leads to the question of, how is this at all art?
Now, so it gets interesting, right? And I'm not aware of these things until I really get into it. So the strategy is, how do I get somebody to talk about something personal? Because that's the interesting thing I want to get on tape, with their dialect, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Not just routine or...
So I thought, okay, I'll ask what their favorite color is. That everybody knows their favorite color. And then I'll start from there. So that's how it started. And then I'll ask them, do you have a story about that color? Like, if your favorite color is green, then it's like, do you have a story about the green color? Whatever, right? So at the beginning, it took me like 30 minutes to really get any kind of private information from a person. And they're still kind of like backing off.
Till they opened up to you and confided.
And then like a month later, it only took like 2 minutes for me to get into the source. I was in Hiroshima, and this woman was a janitor in one of the galleries. So I would ask people if I can borrow their space to do these recordings, and then ask people to come and, you know, maybe 10 to 15 minutes each and just record their voices. So there'll be like galleries or artist-run spaces or cafes, something like that. One was a publishing company in Okinawa, where they got me local poets. That was really interesting too. But the one in Hiroshima, there were two janitors, elder women, just mopping the floor, you know, vacuuming. And I heard their voices, really interesting. I really liked the tone of this one woman's voice. Because up to there, I was just recording, you know, poets and musicians and artists' voices, right? So then I got more curious about other people. And I asked if I could take a recording of her voice. And then we found a private space that was safe. And then asked the favorite color. And it was a green color. And then she started talking about the sweater that her mom knitted for her, that she would keep in a drawer of a dresser. And it's the only thing in that drawer, because her mother died from an atomic bomb.
Mm.
And that was like in a few minutes, it just got right deep like that. And I was so, you know, caught off guard. And her friend too, I think. So we started all crying on the spot. But I thought that was the most successful part of the project. Not that I really need to replay it or, you know, show it or display it. I think that's more like the afterthought, right? I think the moment was more interesting and beautiful that way. Hmm. So I talk about this quite a bit, this episode.
Well, I have two things to say. One, now you've provoked some memories in me. And when I was a kid, my favorite color was blue. But I see what you're doing. You've gotten me to. But I think it was because my brother's favorite color was red. Uh-huh. And we had a rivalry. And he was like that into red. Sense. And there's nothing political. No Republicans or Democrats yet. Okay. Yeah. But it's funny how those colors defined us.
Right.
Like if there was a blue thing in life, whatever, that was something my claim and red was his. A lot of competition between us. So, blue and red. So, okay, that was one comment. Good memory.
Yours is blue?
Well, it was when I was a kid.
Oh.
Now I really just like really colorful things. You can see around my, I just think a mm-hmm. lot of color. Yeah, I wear bright colors.
Yeah.
I just love.
You're wearing three colors.
I'm wearing three bright colors.
Right.
And I my heart now place is filled with art.
Mm-hmm.
I usually have colored lights on.
Oh, nice.
And I just turn them on, and I usually have them cycling through colors. years.
Oh, that's great.
But the more serious question is, well, I'm doing an interview with you now, uh-huh. and it's for radio, uh-huh. and it's kind of art in some, you know, it's radio, mm-hmm. it's an interview, it's a maybe more of documentary or entertainment. In some general sense, it's art. But how is what you're doing with this project more art?
Mm. So that was for me to find out later, right? It's like, okay, I got like 1,000 tracks or clips of these voices, right? And they're all making reference to a color. And sometimes it's like an in-between color, right? It's like, oh, I like turquoise. So where does that fall? Is between blue and green or something, right? When I, you know, at the end of the project, you actually have to do some kind of installation.
In the music. Right, yeah. Okay.
So I had to figure that part out. And the way I figured it out is like, okay, well, I got almost every color, right? So it's sort of like the 48 color pencil box set. So how do I make that an installation? So I'll get 48 speakers, and each one will be dedicated to a color. Mm-hmm. And I'll lay it out in the room, which will be totally dark and have no color at all. And you'll listen to people talking about black, and it'll transition to purple transitioning into blue, and you'll feel the gradient as you pass and listen to these passages. And in a way, when you walk in the room, you have to do this kind of circular thing, which is kind of Buddhist, you know, type of passage, I guess, which I thought was really kind of accidental, but good.
I mean, maybe the art of it, interviewing is enough, but you took something that's a little more narrative or documentary or factual, mm-hmm. and you bumped it up an octave, mm-hmm. into something that, oh, this is really artful now. It's more than just stories.
Right.
You created a project. Right. And I don't know if everybody listening to this understands about installation art and that conceptual world. Uh-huh. Maybe we could talk about
that.
Yeah,
let's talk about it. I'd be happy to, because I'm always trying to figure that out, too. and good question, too. Like, how do you make it into art, right? So for me, it has to do something with my five senses. If it doesn't trigger something, one or two, then I would not make that art, right? It has to be multi-sensory. Otherwise, it's not a good project for me.
Oh, that's interesting. For you personally.
Yeah.
You want it to enter.
So that's the checkpoint. Okay. It's like, okay, I can smell it, I can see it, I can hear it, and there's something to touch. Now that's really good.
Ah.
You know?
Good, I like it.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it has to excite me, you know? Otherwise, I don't even touch it.
That's kind of your thing.
Yeah.
So you find the raw material and then bump it into a little higher frequency.
Yeah, and finding the raw material is also part of the project, too. It's like, how do I find something that nobody really pays attention to, right? And then make it resonate, mm-hmm. you know?
What you're saying also reminds me of a video clip I saw today about an animator named Miyazaki, mm-hmm. who is a famous animation director and producer and writer, mm-hmm. and I hope most people have heard about him. He was saying that he doesn't always know what's going to happen in his movies. He just kind of plays around and does this and that and lets the story develop. And sometimes it's hard for his staff because they don't know. He was saying Spirited Away, one of his famous films. He didn't quite know what it was about until he got in there and started doing it. Sounds like you have something of a similar approach.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good example. I wouldn't say it's the same for me like him, but I do understand how he plays his game or art game. But the similarity is that I pick my characters for this narrative, right? Like, it could be the rock. It could be a random person in the village telling a story, right? And then once I have my cast, then it's like, what can, how are they going to relate, although they're all very different, and that's how the story happens. So even with all those voices, with it making references to all these different colors, the more interesting ones were, like I said, the turquoise one, were like, you know, this purple color. I can't explain to you what that purple is, but it's not your typical purple, you know?
Mm.
It's like, yeah, I want to know more about that.
Mm-hmm. Finishing the explanation about installation art or conceptual art, once it's done, what remains? Like, I have pictures around me that Greg Gibbs and a number of other artists have painted, and it's a permanent thing. It's on my wall. We can see it right there. But after your installation is done, is that it?
That's it. Yeah, that's it. That's why I really appreciate these paintings, because they stay like that, you know? And I can't quite grapple with that. I don't think I can ever really get to that point like that. It's
permanence.
Yeah. I have a lot of respect for people who do this kind of work. But it's not me.
Oh. I don't mean to be too sharp here, but then how do people remember? What comes of it is, I mean, here it is and it's gone. And who's that guy? I mean, what's... I don't know if I'm asking correctly.
No, you're asking correctly.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's also the question that comes up for me, too. I every morning or before going to bed, I would ask those questions like, well, what have I made that remains? You know, and then I can't really compliment things, or I have given things to people because I'm not interested in holding on to it. So I would say 90% of my work is somewhere else, and I'm not really even interested in knowing where they are. Because, you know, there are artists who are fanatic about that, right? They want to know exactly who is owning this painting or this sculpture, and they want to have a track record of it, right?
And money.
And money.
And fame.
Yeah.
Back to where we started. Yeah.
Nothing against that. I think that's great, too.
Residuals.
It's not me.
It's very interesting. I didn't even realize this conversation was going to go this direction, but that's you as an artist.
Yeah.
You don't have a permanent canvas. You create an experience. Perhaps people don't understand at all, or perhaps they're profoundly moved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. When it's done, it's done.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not really even aware if it's profound or not, but I think it's just that I've got this time, you know, 30 minutes or hour or whatever it's going to be, right? It's like, what can I make within this time frame, right?
This is the way art comes out of Keogh Griffiths. It's just the way you're built. This is what you want to do. This is how your muse come. You want to try something, play along the way, figure it out as you go, and the result... there may be no result.
I don't know. I don't know if it's good. I can't really judge it for myself or evaluate it. It might be terrible. It might be horrible. But I know what I'm interested in, though. I'm really like how music works. And I'm interested in how I can make that work for art. You know, the transition is just that moment. And it's not that long. Or there are long ones too, of course, you know, musical pieces. But what could happen like in a minute or 10 minutes or 30 minutes, right? You know, how do they relate to each other?
Well, I hope this isn't a tortured comparison, but it reminds me of haiku.
I love haiku.
It's almost like, what is it even? You know, no, where's the rhyme? You know, what's the point?
I love haiku. Actually,
it's like a snapshot, or
yeah, it's like a snapshot, but it's also like a really good chess game.
Okay,
because you're given a number of syllables to work with, 17, and with the 17 syllables, you can rearrange it any way you want. The typical thing is the 5-7-5 format, right? The three lines, but you can change that too. You can break it up within the 17 syllables. You have to create a picture that has all these senses in it. You have to touch on a certain season or time, right? Without being too obvious. like using something symbolic, right? Like a tomato or a pear or something. Because, you know, a pear could represent fall, right? But it could also represent a certain time in fall, right? Early autumn, perhaps. And it could get very specific. Well, one thing I like about Japan is that the seasons can be broken up in 52 seasons, right? So you got the typical four seasons, and then every week is a different season. And I think that kind of sensibility alludes for me to make that project, like that project of recording voices. It's kind of like that. It's like, how by doing this, would I notice the differences, you know, the different shades in the voice or the intonation or whatever, right? It's like, how would I be aware of the accent that would drop suddenly in their speaking, you know? Kind of like, you know, listening to a really good guitar riff, right? When you get to that point, it's like, that's the accent, you know?
It just lands, you know it,
right.
You feel it.
Right.
And ultimately, that's what you're looking for. It's just, maybe it's not that rational, makes sense, but it just lands. It's like, here it is.
Right.
It feels like a creation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. Well, I don't know. I'm not really that conscious of those things, though, like if it's art or creation, but more involved, I guess, for the ride. Like, you know, if you're listening to ambient music, it's like, well, which plateau am I going to fall into, you know, unexpectedly, right? Well, I didn't know I was going to go to this area over here. Like, I went really deep. So that's the sort of thing that I like. It's like allowing the body to navigate your mind.
This conversation is about a struggle that the Western mind is working out. Like, we tend to want things that make sense, beginning, middle, end. We want a religion that promises us heaven when we die. Just believe this and you get heaven. Done. It's very simple. We want music that has a chorus and a verse that's satisfying. And we want a piece of art that we can hang above our door.
I love that structure too.
So, like, we want something that we understand that's mm-hmm. solid and concrete.
Mm-hmm.
But so much of art doesn't fit into that. And that's why, you know, artists are misunderstood or scary or discounted or ignored or attacked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you're dealing with a force that's chaos, but chaos in a good way, that really is beyond rules. And the best of art, well, we already did that art. Now we want a whole new kind of art. Otherwise, it's just kind of the same old thing you're redoing, right? So we want the chaos,
mm-hmm.
but then we want to be able to understand it. But maybe in Van Gogh, nobody understood him. He sold like one piece in his whole life to his brother. The highest selling art on the planet right now, I believe, one of the highest. So nobody got him when he was alive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's this conversation about the artist and how vulnerable and fragile and what
good,
is it?
I have a good Van Gogh story. It's one of the summer holidays. My dad took me back to, he's from Long Island, New York. So, and then we went to a gallery that was showing Van Gogh. And then I was fixated on that ear with a bandage.
Yeah.
I think I was like five, maybe. I was like, whoa, what is this? And I just stood there. I can't move myself. I was transfixed and, in a way, kind of possessed. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if it was art or anything, but it was similar to what I just mentioned earlier. It took me somewhere, right? I was on a kind of kind of trip.
That makes me want to tell my Van Gogh ghost story.
What is that?
You see, you, that's what you do, don't you? I went to see Van Gogh, the Van Gogh show at LACMA, early 70s. And I think my parents dragged me along, like, why do I want to go to this silly thing? And I'm walking through the gallery, and there's first, like, these dark, ugly paintings, and I'm going, who is this guy? You know, Van Gogh had his early period, and it's kind of, like, hard to understand stuff. But then it got to, I remember
I got to agree. And when I first walked in the gallery, I was like, oh, this is gross.
His so, dark pictures.
It's so muddy.
There's a name for that period.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
It just doesn't seem, you know, hygienic.
But then I got to the picture called Sunflowers. Hmm. And I had seen this picture many times in photographs. And it was all right. And I was standing there in front of it and went like, oh, this is entirely different. This is a profound, this isn't just a picture of like some two-dimensional, this is like a, it really hit me. I got it. Oh, you know, like I went, I understood how important it is to see real art in person, you know, and not just like some derivation of it, to be present.
I think I probably had the same reaction. Because it was so physical, his brush strokes, you know. And it really kind of made me jump a little bit, you know. And then I got really into learning more about painting. I think really, mostly through Van Gogh, probably, I think. And went to the Impressionists, which I didn't find too interesting compared, because it seemed kind of light-coated and washed a little bit. But then there were the Expressionists, which are quite as involved with the physicality of the paint and the brush strokes, right? It's almost like wrestling on the canvas, you know?
Hmm. You see the process more.
Yeah, yeah. It's very active and... Yeah, you struggle. You see the struggle.
Mm.
Yeah.
I will say, when I went in the early 70s, I remember there was hardly anybody at the exhibit. And then they had another show of his in the last decade. He couldn't get tickets. And I said, yeah, I don't want to wait 4 hours to... already seen it.
So... there's a short period between the Impressionists and Expressionists called the FOB.
The FOBs, yeah.
You know, right? Yeah. Which I think Gauguin was part of it before he split and became one of the Nabi artists.
Okay,
right?
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Kind of like the alternative rock movement of painting, I think. And I found that to be really interesting. It's like they wanted to push the color, the hue of the color, even more intense. And probably not just the physicality, but also like how loud and how more emotional you can get through working well, the medium. The first thing that you think about FOB is like, oh, are they really angry?
Mm.
But then you look into it and say, no, it's not about... You might think about that they're angry and like, you know, really getting their emotions out on you, but it's really that control, right, that's within themselves. It's like, how do you externalize this fear? How do you externalize this, you know, mounting heat or whatever it is, you know, that's happening in your body, right? This furnace.
And a lot of these Impressionist artists had many different phases, many different interests. Picasso, he explored many different styles, and we continue to do that.
Yeah, that's why I find modern art to be really important even now. It's become very mainstream or like traditional in a way that, you know, most people know what it's about. But I think the trajectory is the important thing. Like, how did Picasso start with the blue period and then go into cubism and then, you know, end up becoming more like an improvised painter or a drawer, in fact, right? Like that, I think it's like a 15-minute film by Renoir's grandson, or was it his son? Picasso's behind a sheet of paper with a marker, right? An oil marker. And he just goes drawing. And the oil marker would just kind of permeate the paper, and you see the markings on the other side. Kind of like an etch-a-sketch.
Yeah.
But being really free, and it's like all of a sudden you have this amazing picture within like 5 minutes.
Where do you see things going for you, or speculate about the future of the art scene in general? What's the future?
No, that's so difficult. Because, you know, we went through a really tough phase, a shift in the last 2 years, right? Troubling, but also, you know, it was a reality check in many ways. Even for art, too. It's like, you know, half the time I'm asking myself, is it worth making what I'm trying to make, right? Who is it helping, right? Am I wasting something? What kind of material am I using? Is it biodegradable, right? That's the sort of thing that's always in your mind now.
Not an issue that most people would even consider.
Not previously. It's like people just pick up a spray can or, you know, whatever, and just go about doing it. Just create and be done with it, right?
But suddenly the environmental, the political, becomes very salient to art, maybe essential to consider.
I think, you know, the bigger theme is that we're being challenged to be more diverse, right? So that's happened. I mean, Black Lives Matter has existed even before that, but it became more amplified through the pandemic and with other things too, right?
LGBTQ community, the just terrible rending of culture over these really hot issues, and the positionality people are taking, the bitter culture wars happening. Well, of course, that's going to be a part of art, which may make art very interesting, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's going back to what I said earlier about tuning into unheard voices, tuning into, you know, the underrepresented, right? And really, I think that's going to be more, make the future more interesting, is that what's going to happen from this, right? Maybe things are not going to be as confrontational in a little while, you know, because that also has to settle down at one point. But right now, we have to fight doing all that stuff, right? Because it's a necessity. But eventually, I think it would all kind of merge and coalesce and become this other thing that we can't even imagine, right? We can't even talk about it. But it, nonetheless, it's really interesting, though, I think, you know.
One thing for sure about artists, whatever you give us, war, plague, famine, whatever we're dealt with, love, heartbreak, we will find a way to turn it into art.
Right.
Keo Griffith, KIOGRIFFITH on Instagram. People can find you there and see what you're up to.
Yeah.
What novel creation?
I did have a website. I mean, I still have it, but it's been kind of infected with a virus. It goes to a Chanel ad or something, which is kind of funny.
We need to give it some vaccine.
I know.
Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you for this time.
here, my house, when you know there's no chairs and tables and beds up in my house, and you still trying to sit up there looking cute? That don't go on in my house, okay? There's no chairs in my house, no tables in my house, no beds in my house. You dance in my house, dance in my house, dance in my house.
Coming to the end of In a Dream with Mystic Pete. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. We started the show with a tune by Anthony Alvarez, Bright Out. Then my interview with Keo Griffith, and just wrapped it up with a tune by Shaman Durek, My House. And I'll leave you with a little poem I wrote. This is a haiku. Actually, this is a rhyming, darkly humorous haiku. Broken wing of dove brings a smile to a child as a feathered glove. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out!